Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Jenny Dearborn. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Susan David, psychiatrist and author of Emotional Agility, Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. Dr. David is an internationally recognized leader in the areas of employee engagement, high performance leadership, and organizational culture change. She is co-founder and co-director of the Institute for Coaching at McLean Hospital and CEO of Evidence-Based Psychology, a management consultancy firm. She is also a faculty member at Harvard Medical School. Throughout her career, Dr. David has worked with hundreds of organizations, including the United Nations, Ernst & Young Global, and the World Economic Forum. She is the author of The Definitive Oxford Handbook of Happiness, and Beyond Goals, Effective Strategies for Coaching and Mentoring. And her top-rated Harvard Business Review article, Emotional Agility, was named Management Idea of the Year. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Susan David.
Thank you so much for having me. When I was writing Emotional Agility, I was concerned with one key question. What does it take internally in the way we deal with our thoughts, our emotions, our stories? Thoughts about whether we're good enough, emotions, fear, sadness, anger, and stories about whether we should or shouldn't apply for a job, how we are destined to be in the world, and how we can be more effective. Emotional agility is the ability to be with your thoughts, your emotions, your stories in a way that is curious, kind, and compassionate, and enables you, even in the most difficult circumstances, to bring the best of yourself forward. I first became interested in emotional agility and in emotions specifically growing up in apartheid South Africa. While I was a white South African and therefore not subject to the same atrocities as my fellow friends were subject to, it was nonetheless a chaotic environment to grow up in. Every day we would see pictures and footage on the television of people having tires put around their neck and set alight. When I was growing up, statistically, your chances of being raped were higher than your chances of learning how to read and write. A friend was gang raped. My uncle was murdered. And this was not unique to me. This was just part and parcel of growing up in a chaotic, difficult, and challenging environment. And I remember very clearly as a 5-6-year-old child, we had a nanny, just like many, many, many families had. And I remember this woman just treating me in such a loving, kind, compassionate way. She was there with me when I was sick. She was on birthdays when I came home from school and I was sad. And over time, that realization that this woman who was with me, almost a mother to me, was not able to be a mother to her own children, who were not allowed to live on a property that was designated white. And so every year, she would save through the year and buy her children, who lived 5 hours away, shoes. And I remember years later talking to her child and saying, my one memory was of my mother coming back for 2 days every Christmas. And she always bought me this gift of shoes that she had saved up for the whole year. And the shoes were always, always too small. Because Anna, of course, in her mind, her 5-year-old had become 6. And she had lost that lifetime of experience and love. So how do you deal with chaos and challenge? And even in our everyday life, where we experience so much, because although every newspaper we would open would tell us that our job is to just be happy, the reality is that life's beauty is inseparable from its fragility. That we are happy until we are not. We are with the people we love until we are not. We are well and thriving until we are ill. We're in a job we love until, for some reason, that job is no longer working for us or with us. So life's beauty is inseparable from its fragility, and I believe that as a society, we need to get better at cultivating the skills that we truly need to thrive in the reality of life, not as we want it to be when we open a newspaper and it tells us four ways to happiness today, but life as it is, which is beautiful and fragile. Because when we look at the statistics, that by 2030, depression is predicted to be the single leading cause of disability globally, outstripping cancer, outstripping heart disease. The rates of 5 and 6 year old children who are now diagnosed with mental illness is around 1 in 10. And this is something that I believe that we as a society and we in organizations are not fully coming to terms with, are not fully facing. I don't believe that this idea of being positive and being happy is enabling us to deal with the reality of emotions, the reality of our thoughts and our stories, the reality of life as it is. So when I was 15, after growing up in that context, my father was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And it was such an interesting and lonely experience. Because every day people would say to me, just be positive, think positive, everything will be fine. And as a friend who recently died of terminal cancer, she had stage 4 breast cancer, described it, she called it the tyranny of positivity. That there she was going through the most difficult experience of her life. And everyone came to her with very good intentions. Just be positive, think positive, things will be fine, just be fine. And she said to me, Susan, if I could think my way out of cancer, I would. And if it was a case of just being positive, all of those people in my breast cancer support group would be alive today, because they are the most positive and were the most positive people that I know. And telling me to just think positive does two things to me. First, it takes away from the authenticity of my experience, my capacity to be and be real with the people that I love today in the time that I truly have left. And secondly, it makes me feel culpable for my own death. That somehow I wasn't positive enough. I didn't have good enough thoughts in a way that enabled me to be cured. And a story that I didn't share in my book, because it was actually just too painful at the time, was that my father, who had been diagnosed with terminal cancer, who had been paying life insurance for decades, 6 months before he died, cancelled his life insurance. Because in his frantic desperation to stay alive, he somehow got it into his mind that having life insurance was a sign that he did not have enough faith. And this was someone who was the most loving, kind, beautiful person. So what is emotional agility? A good way for me to probably describe emotional agility is to think about its opposite, emotional rigidity. And I'll give two examples that are front of mind. The first is of an individual that was working at a very large professional services firm. And I was consulting with this company, and I became privy to a piece of information, which was that this woman was destined for a life-changing promotion. She was going to be in the top 10 of this 180,000 people organization. And while the organization could have, should have, dealt with it differently, they decided that they were not going to tell her yet, because her promotion was part of a very important organizational change project, and it was under wraps, and it was going to take 18 months to get all the pieces in place, and they decided to keep this information. So I went off on maternity leave, and when I came back, this woman's office was empty. And I said to her, "What happened? What has happened?" And she said to me, "Things started to change. I walked into meetings and people, I just felt that they were treating me differently. There was clearly something going on." And I determined, I got it into my mind that I was going to be fired. So I went into meetings and I started to shut down. When I was asked to contribute, I became cynical. Why was I being treated so badly by this organization? Clearly, this is being agile. All my ghosts. So she said to me, I started to shut down. I started to close off. And then I said to the organization, "What happened?" And they said the same thing. Here was this individual who we had such high hopes for. But she started to become cynical. She started to become negative. She started to close down. She started to shut down. Now you might say, well, you know, the organization was wrong. But fundamentally, when I said to this woman, and if you'd have asked her, who is it that you most want to be in the world? What kind of leader, what kind of person do you most want to be? She would have said a contributor. She would have said a contributor. So what we have is a situation where this intention of how I want to be is discordant from the reality of how I come across. And we all have this. We experience it. We have ideas of how we want to lead. I've never met a leader who says, "I don't care what my team thinks, and I don't really care about inclusiveness." I've never met a parent who says, "I don't want to be there for my child." But how often is it that we come home from work and we say to our child, "How was your day?" without looking up from our phone? And he grunts, "Fine," without looking up from his. So my other example of emotional rigidity is one from my own life. A couple of years ago, I was working on a concept that was so important to me. And in an unguarded moment at a conference, when a colleague far more senior and famous than I will ever be, said to me, "What is it you're working on?" And I mentioned to him, and I saw from the glimmer in his eye that I had said too much. And months later, I was working in Starbucks, as one does. And I got a message from this colleague saying to me, "I've been writing a book, and we're really struggling with the title. I hope you don't mind, but I want to use the concept as the title for my new book." I put the phone down. Mind? Of course I'm minded. And I realized as the trap door to my heart opened, that sense of betrayal, that sense of stupidity in myself, why did I say it? As I went online to Amazon and I realized that it was not a rhetorical question because that book was already available for pre-sale. So I did what most people would do. I called my husband to vent. And as he picked up the phone, he is a physician at the Mass Gen, and he answered the phone and he said to me, "Susie, I'm so sorry, but I can't talk. I've got a patient lying on the table waiting for an emergency procedure." Clunk. That feeling of the one time that I needed him. He's not there for me. It takes so much for me to actually reach out to someone for help. And then the one day that I do, he's not available. I then planned that when his callback came, which it would be my turn to be unavailable. Brilliant. So there I spent 3 days in a snit at my guiltless husband, whose only crime was trying to save his patient's life. And yet we all do this in our own form, in our own way. In psychology, we describe this as being fused, this idea that your thoughts and your actions become fused. I feel that I'm being undermined in the meeting, so I'm just going to shut down. I am so angry with my boss for taking my ideas away that I'm just not going to share anymore. I feel like a fraud, so I'm just going to keep quiet. My wife is starting in on the finances again, so I'm just going to leave the room. So this idea of conflation is essentially when we have a stimulus, a thought, an emotion, a story, an experience in our lives. And what we do is we act in a patterned way where our thoughts, our emotions, our stories dominate. Rather than who we are. Rather than what we want to be. Because we are more than our thoughts. We are more than our emotions. Who is in charge? The thinker or the thought? Who is in charge, the emotion or me, the person who is able to contain many emotions? Who is in charge, the story of I'm just not going to get the job, so I may as well not apply? Or me, who is big enough and complex enough as a human being to contain many stories? Because if you'd have said to me in that moment, or if you'd have asked me, "Who do you want to be in your relationship?" I would have said, and this is just language that I use, for me, having a relationship that is clean is really important. And what I mean by clean is that my husband is actually allowed to be busy without worrying that I'm going to serve divorce papers on him. He is allowed to say something without feeling that he's walking on eggshells. That it is a relationship in which people can be and be whole and be connected with one another without, over a period of months and years and decades, feeling that there are just no-go zones in the relationship. Because now what we've done is we've tweaked our way into a being that looks very different from the life that we actually truly want and from bringing the values that we truly want to the table. I believe that human beings' greatest suffering is the inability to recognize that a thought is just a thought, an emotion, just an emotion. Emotions contain value. They often are signals to things that we most care about, but they are not fact. So emotional agility is the process of being able to be with all of our thoughts, our emotions, our stories in a way that is curious, in a way that connects with them, and in a way that actually surfaces underneath them what is crucial and what is meaningful to us. I have never met someone who is depressed, who isn't looking for a way of better being in the world. I've never met someone with social anxiety who isn't fundamentally concerned about how to belong better. I've never met someone in a meeting who's upset that their idea was stolen, who isn't fundamentally concerned about issues of equity and fairness. So beneath our thoughts, beneath our stories, beneath our emotions, often contain nuggets, signals, beacons to things that we truly care about. But we need to, as human beings, especially in an age where the very demands of our society are at odds with our ability to be agile, where every organization is saying we want employees who are adaptive and connected and flexible. And yet the very paradox is that the complexity that we find ourselves in an organizational context means that when we are time poor and stressed, instead of being collaborative, we become competitive. Instead of being relational, we just send out the 300 emails and are transactional, forgetting to ask the staff member how their child is, the child who is gravely ill. We become much more focused on getting things done, and we become much more subject to massive levels of panic, strain, and guilt. Viktor Frankl, who survived the Nazi death camps, wrote, "Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space lies our power to choose. And it is in that choice that comes our growth and our freedom." And emotional agility is the process of recognizing when it is that you are hooked, when it is that the answer just seems so clear to you, just as mine was of not answering the phone again, just as my client's was of shutting down. And yet if we are able to cultivate the skills of being able to be effective with our thoughts, our emotions, and stories, and instead come to our choices with greater levels of intentionality, of connection, of values, of recognizing that our success in life is fundamentally about whether we are living the life that is connected with what we value, and are able to make habit changes that are congruent with it, then it will be very difficult for us and our children to thrive in ways that are full and whole, and to recognize that sometimes what seems to be a very simple answer actually has many different solutions and many different possibilities. So in emotional agility, I describe ways of being with our thoughts, our emotions, our stories effectively, key skills from a psychological perspective that we fundamentally need to cultivate and help our children to cultivate, so that our children recognize that thoughts and especially emotions are not to be feared. They are not bigger than them. That the small being that we see in front of us develops the capability to feel adept and competent with their emotions, because they are going to face a life and a world in which they will experience fragility. So what are some of the key skills that I describe in emotional agility? The first is what I call showing up. And what I mean by showing up is probably best described in another story, which is also by a Nazi death camp survivor. Primo Levi described how he, when his death camp was liberated, experienced one of the most traumatic experiences in his life. He and his fellow survivors boarded a train, and the train took them back to their hometown. They'd been away for years, emaciated, terrified, traumatized, and relieved. They got off the train, and their fellow townspeople came to them and said, "What has happened to you?" And Levi described how, as the words and the memories came tumbling out, the townspeople turned and walked away, unable to metabolize, unable to come face to face with what they were being told. And Levi describes this as being more traumatic than many of the experiences that he had in the death camp itself, because he speaks to this critical human need to be seen. To be seen. In emotional agility, I describe this context of not just seeing others, but of seeing ourselves. When we live in a world where people tell us we need to be happy all the time, what that can lead to is us either bottling and pushing our emotions aside, or overthinking them and overanalyzing, what I call brooding, in ways that are not helpful, in ways that are long-term predictive of poorer levels of problem solving and of lower levels of well-being. So showing up is the ability to come to yourself in a way that is quite literally not arguing with whether you should or shouldn't have a particular thought or emotion, or whether you should or shouldn't be upset or angry or concerned or worried about whatever it is that you're upset or worried or angry or concerned about. Quite literally, the idea that we can drop any struggle with inside ourselves by dropping the rope. That we don't need to, in psychology, what we call type one thoughts, where you say, "I'm sad about something." And then type two thoughts, when you start layering in thoughts about your thoughts. "I shouldn't have that thought. I shouldn't be so sad because everyone else around me is." Drop the struggle by dropping the rope. And when we live again in a world that would treat us and teach us that we are forever in an Iron Man or Iron Woman triathlon. To extend to ourselves the same care that you might to a child and the same level of compassion. Because what is fascinating is often people who are hard on themselves feel that self-compassion is fuzzy, going weak, being lazy. In fact, the research shows the opposite, that when you have had a failure, a setback at work, when you're going through a tough situation, a divorce, a death, a transition, that people who are kind to themselves are more resilient, they thrive, and they are more likely to find their way through that context. A second aspect that I talk about is the idea of developing what we call a meta skill. Meta skills are the ability to be able to be on the phone to a customer service agent, frothing at the mouth, because after 232 hours, you have finally gotten hold of a human being. And as the words start tumbling out of your mouth as to why you are so angry at the fact that they've gotten your bill wrong again, that little voice goes off in your mind that says, Susan, being like this is not going to get you very far. She'll probably conveniently lose your file. So meta skills are the ability to both experience an emotion, experience a thought, but to be able to helicopter above it. And it is a critical skill set. Very simply, and I give some very practical examples in emotional agility. If you find yourself every single day coming home and saying, I'm stressed. How was your day? I'm stressed. It was just stressful. It was a stressful day. What you're doing when you say, I am stressed, is you are conflating 100% I am with stress. There is no space between you and the experience of stress. You don't have that meta skill. Simply being able to label, and this is called emotion granularity, the difference between stress versus anger, stress versus disappointment, stress versus betrayal, stress versus upset, stress versus I need to delegate more, stress versus I thought my career would be so different than it is so empowering and has been shown to shape the readiness potential in our brain. So literally the part of our brain that activates in helping us to set goals and achieve outcomes is changed by accurate labeling of emotion. A third process that I talk about in emotional agility is the idea of walking your why. Fascinating work shows that we are all subject to what is called social contagion. If you on an aeroplane are sitting next to a seatmate who buys chocolate, even if you don't know the person, you are 30% more likely to buy snacks and sweets as well. If someone in an elevator is looking at the cell phone, you are likely to pick up your cell phone and look at it as well. Large-scale epidemiological studies show that when someone in your social network, even if you do not know the person, puts on weight or gets divorced, your chances of putting on weight or getting divorced go up significantly. Social contagion is real. And yet, we know that when people take time to actually think about what is important to them, what their values are, it is fundamentally protective. For example, first year and first generation college goers are much more likely to drop out of college when they face a setback because they've often grown up with a cultural bias of you don't belong here. So when they fail their first exam, they start seeing it subconsciously as a reinforcement of I don't belong here. We know the same with women in science, that often we have cultural biases that we grow up with and that get activated when we experience setbacks or difficulties in our lives. And yet, when people have taken literally, in some pieces of research, 10 minutes to take some time thinking about what is important to them, it is protective year on year of these kinds of setbacks. The litmus of effectiveness and success in your life is whether you are living a life that is concordant with what you value, with the heartbeat of your own why. And thinking about how to cultivate this effectively can help us to make real changes. I'm going to close by giving one quick example of how knowing what your values are literally alters the physics of willpower. Imagine you are trying to lose weight, and you have what we call a have-to goal. A have-to goal is a goal that is often derived from a sense of obligation or shame. Your doctor's at you. Your wife is at you to lose weight. And so you've got this goal, but it's driven by obligation and shame. We know that when you go to the refrigerator and open the refrigerator, if there is a piece of chocolate cake in that refrigerator, that is what you see. It is all that is there, and you want it. On the other hand, if you have a want-to goal, a want-to goal is derived from a sense of what is intrinsically important to you. A colleague of mine for many years had tried to lose weight, gone to personal trainers, was traveling all the time, and was completely out of routine and very, very unhealthy. He had adopted a child from Nicaragua, and this child for the first 2 years of his life had lived in the most horrific circumstances, in a crib, unheld and untouched for 2 years, fed over the sides of the crib. This little boy was adopted by my client and had profound learning difficulties, but turned out to be a beautiful, beautiful artist. And one day he painted a picture of himself, but not as a 2-year-old, as a 16-year-old. And he called the picture The Orphan. My client looked at the picture and said, "I understand the picture, but why an orphan at the age of 16? And this little boy started to cry and said, "Because I know I will be an orphan again. I know that you will die because of your health." This is a want-to goal. My client described how immediately the goal shifted into something that was intrinsically important. Now imagine you've got a want-to goal and you open that refrigerator. What is fascinating is that your brain processes taste attributes 195 milliseconds before you know you're even making a decision. So all this thing about high willpower, low willpower doesn't even come into the equation. Your brain knows whether you are going to be eating the chocolate cake before you even know you are making a choice as to whether or not to eat it. But what is fascinating is that when we have a have-to goal, it ramps up temptation, and that is the very thing we want. When we have a want-to goal, it ramps down temptation, literally altering the physics of our motivation and enabling us to make tiny tweaks to cultivate changes to our habits and our lives that time on and time on and time on literally change the course of who we are. So are you being emotionally agile right now? 3 quick questions. Are there any things in your life where you are so focused on being right that feeling when you've had an argument in the house and quiet descends, and then something compels you to tell your partner or your spouse one more time why you were right and they were wrong? Is there anything in your life where you're so focused on being right, whether it's at work or in a relationship or with a loved one, that you have given away your ability to do what actually serves you, what is meaningful? Question number 2. Are you adopting what I call dead people's goals? If you ever hear yourself saying, I don't want to reach out in case I'm rejected. I don't want to put my hand up for that project in case I fail. I don't want to fail. I don't want to get anxious. I don't want to get nervous. I don't want to disappoint. Then you are using dead people as your role models. Because dead people never fail. They never get anxious. They never disappoint. They never get rejected. And then question number three, are you doing what is workable? What I'm meaning by workable is, are you taking action today that is bringing you closer to being the leader, the parent, the person that you most want to be? There are small things that we do every day. We avoid a conversation, even though in the theme of workability, it's not bringing us closer to being the leader that we want to be. Or we have a conversation with a child that might feel comfortable in the moment because I'm on my phone or I'm distracted, but is not workable in terms of who I want to be. So emotional agility, the ability to make space for your thoughts, your emotions, your stories in a way that is curious, courageous, compassionate, to be able to show up to them and to bring values and intentionality in real practical ways in terms of how you change your habits and your motivations and your mindsets so that you can love, live, parent, and lead in the world as it is, not as we want it to be. Thank you. Thank you. Can you have a seat?
Great, thank you. So why don't you start off by telling us a little bit more about how women and men react differently to their emotions and how they can apply emotional agility according to gender?
Very good question, and one that a lot of people are interested in. So one of the things that I spoke about was the difference between emotional reactions. Often when people are hooked, so when they're being emotionally rigid, they tend to react in one of two ways. The first is bottling, where we push emotions aside and we say, I'm just going to focus on the project, I'm just going to go off to work, I'm going to get on with it. And what the research shows is that men tend to do that more than women. So men tend to be much more focused on compartmentalizing and almost pushing emotions aside, whereas women are much more likely to do what we call brood. And brooding is going over and over and over the emotions. Sometimes we can also co-brood. And co-brood is when you go out with your best friend and you have a big fat moan about how your father isn't managing his finances. And what's definitional about brooding is that it's not moving towards labeling emotion and resolution. What's really fascinating is, and you know, I always get, you know, skeptical about gender differences because, of course, we're unique. So people might switch from one to the other. And, you know, if you're a man, you might brood, you know, don't want to make too much of it. But the research definitely shows that there are these two different ways that people often deal with emotions. And what's fascinating is that even though they look so different, they are both actually over time associated with lower levels of resilience and thriving, and really interestingly, more difficulty in actually solving the problem because your mind is so taken up with what's going on that the capacity to actually bring yourself with intention to the issue is challenged. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Can you say more about the science behind the ability to boost willpower and change habits?
Yeah, so there's fascinating, of course, you know, this example that I just spoke about, there's fascinating work that looks at this example of willpower. But really what has not been brought into the discussion about willpower and habit change is how the way we think about the habits that we want to change, whether they are really aligned with our values and how we actually frame them is really, really critical. And of course then, and I explore this in emotional agility, there is a science to habit change. And, you know, for example, one of the strategies that I talk about is this idea of piggybacking. So piggybacking is where you've got a habit that is already inculcated. You every single day come home from work and you put your car keys in a particular drawer. So you do that every single day. So the idea of changing habit in intentional ways is that you might say to yourself, giving the example that I gave with speaking on the phone with the kids, you might say something like, I'm putting my keys in the drawer and I'm also now going to create a habit, which is a piggybacked habit of putting my phone in the same drawer. So they're very, very specific ways that we can start to alter habits. But what's really fascinating is that habit change does not happen effectively unless it is actually connected with this heartbeat of why it is from a want-to perspective rather than a have-to perspective.
Exactly. Can you describe a client or a colleague who did not realize they had emotional rigidity and how you help them to first sort of acknowledge the issue and bring it to their attention? Is that something that you can only understand in yourself, or can you go up to say, hey, pal, I think you got a pro- it's called emotional rigidity.
Well, I mean, I do a lot of work in this context, but I mean, I can give you some examples. You know, one is I spoke about this idea of getting more nuanced around labeling emotion. So I had a client that I was working with, a CEO, who was very, very quick to anger. And he would always say, you know, my team is angry, my team is angry, my team is angry. And he would always use the same language. And I then started to hear in conversation when he was telling me about discussions he'd had with his wife, that his wife was also very angry. And I started to say to him, you know, why don't we just kind of pull back a little bit from this and, you know, what are two other options? Because so often we come to an emotion, we say, I'm stressed or I'm angry, but there's actually something that is really often beautiful and revealing underneath it. And he started to say, you know, my team is anxious, or, you know, my wife is actually feeling really sad, that what he was just automatically reading as anger was actually something quite different. Mm-hmm. And it was completely, he described it months later as life-changing for him, because this mental model that he was coming into all conversations with was actually just very different from the reality of what people were experiencing.
Mm-hmm. In my line of work, when someone experiences that, I try to understand what's underneath it that's good. So when someone says, I'm really frustrated, I say, well, at the core of frustration is that you really care deeply and you really want a good outcome. Let's make sure that we get to that good outcome, you know, and
absolutely.
Just get past that emotion.
Absolutely. You know, I think, again, we live in a society where our emotions are often seen as, you know, warm and fluffy and irrational. And it's our emotions, the way we deal with our thoughts, our emotions, and our stories is the single biggest predictor of our lifelong success and effectiveness. It literally predicts our relationships, what jobs we put our hands up for, how we deal with failures, it's everything. And yet this whole idea that emotions are somehow bad is just, you know, Charles Darwin wrote the expression of emotions in Man and Animals, in which he described this idea that emotions have a function. And one of the things that I talk about in emotional agility is that it's really helpful to try to discern what the function is beneath an emotion. I give an example of when I'm on the road a lot. I used to arrive in a hotel room and I would be like feeling guilt because I was away from my kids, and there was this strong sense of guilt. And then I would brood about the guilt, and then I'd be like, oh, I'm a bad mom. And I started to just try to listen to the heartbeat of what was beneath that guilt. And, you know, really, one of the things that I talk about in emotional agility is our thoughts are thoughts, they're not facts. Our emotions are emotions, they're not facts. But we can still discern something of true value from them. So I think this idea of paying more attention and trying to generate learning from emotion is often critical, and I've seen the opposite. You know, I've seen situations where people say things like, I'm unhappy and I'm just going to push through. And 5 years later of pushing through in the same job, the person's like, I wasted so much. But because they haven't been able to actually connect with the value, the signpost that's beneath that emotion.
Mm-hmm. This also tends to be negative consequences in the vocabulary that we use when someone says, you're being really emotional. And I guess the response should be is, of course we all are because we're human beings, you know. But the you're being emotional tends to have a really negative connotation.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, I think for so many people, especially this whole, you know, happiness movement, and believe me, I'm not anti-happiness. You know, I'm a fairly happy person, and I wrote an 80-chapter book called The Oxford Handbook of Happiness. I'm not anti-happiness. But I think what's really interesting is what this whole idea about we've all got to be happy all the time does is it leads us to often struggle. You know, when we're feeling unhappy about something, we feel like we've just got to put in a brave face and go out into the world rather than learn from that emotion. And then, you know, my other thing with this, the whole happiness movement is I think that at some level it really starts to suggest to people that happiness is just a choice. You know, just choose to be happy. And when you look at the research showing that, you know, when I get out of bed and I live 3 hours away from home and I'm commuting and I don't have public transport and there are real social policies that impact on my ability to get a job, be effective in the job. And then you're telling me that, like, it's only because I've chosen unhappy. You know, I think social policies can and do impact on people's well-being. And I think that this idea of, oh, you know, if you're unhappy regardless of your circumstances, just choose otherwise, actually takes away from our compassionate societal responsibility to look at the issues that we face and see how, as a community, we can deal with it, because it somehow kind of implies that it's just up to the person to get over whatever it is that they're dealing with and just choose happiness.
Do you see a connection between social media and the happiness movement, either in the research or in your opinion? I remember different research reports reading that when on Facebook, when someone, you know, posts something sad, you know, their daily update, feeling really bummed today, you know, people tend to not comment, and then you eventually you lose connections.
Yes.
But if people write in every day, having a great day, always happy, then there you get lots of likes, and then your network grows. So there's this social isolation that comes with not being happy, which is sort of a downward spiral because of social media. Do you see any connection there?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. One of the things that I talk about in the book is, firstly, this idea of social contagion, especially about how we – there's fascinating work showing that you can start tracking literally 10, 12, 15 degrees of separation changes in people's moods via social contagion. So one of the studies that I quote in the book, and it's all very, you know, I quote the studies but in ways that are highly practical, is research showing that if people in a hospital, that the individuals who come into a hospital and if something's happened at home that's upset you, these individuals are asked to keep a diary. And what you start seeing is the social contagion that starts to happen in the hospital setting where, you know, even though I've got nothing to do with your upset, I start catching it. So I very much, you know, there's that, and then there's also this very real thing that happens, of course, in social media, which is we start then really engaging in social comparison. And social comparison is one of the most toxic things that we can do for ourselves psychologically. This person's got a better house and that person's got a better car. It is absolutely toxic. And, of course, you know, people tend to post all of the wonderful things that they're doing, so social comparison is there all the time. And it's something that we really need to protect against as people who are trying to kind of get on with and get on in the world. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Can you share any advice for parents or how we can raise emotionally agile kids in our community? Any ideas for parents?
Absolutely. So in emotional agility, I actually spend a whole chapter talking about this. So let me just say that I am like not a paragon of virtue when it comes to, I give this example in emotional agility where I talk about having a six-week-old baby. I've got an eight-year-old now and a three-year-old daughter. But when I took my son, my eight-year-old, when he was 6 weeks old, I took him to the doctor, and he was getting his first shots. And it's this quite kind of bizarre thing because there I was, a first-time mom, and very, very, wanting to do the right thing. And I hand him over to the doctor, and he had never cried tears. I'd never seen tears before because, they take a while to develop their tears. So there he was, all guggly and googly and smiling, and I hand him over to the doctor, which is fairly bizarre because you, this protected and protective person, giving your child over effectively to be hurt. So Noah goes from guggly, googly, smiley, smiley, smiley into outrage. I mean, his face went beet red and he started screaming. And I picked him up and I said to him, "It's okay, it's okay, it's okay." And the nurse, very lovingly, without stopping what she was doing, said to me, "It's not okay. It's not okay. It will be okay, but it's not okay." And I then, of course, went home and beat myself up because I had a PhD in this stuff. And, I should have known better. And so, brooded about it. And my husband came home from work and I said to him, "You will never believe what I said to Noah. I said, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay." And my husband looked at me in this like very bemused, deadpan, he's got a brilliant sense of humor. And he said to me, "It's okay, Sue. It's okay." but to answer your question, it's fascinating. Often with the best of intentions, our kids come home from school and they say, "Mommy, no one would play with me today," or they've had something that's happened. And often with the best of intentions, we are so pained ourselves at what they're experiencing that we often kind of rush in and try to save them and fix them. Yeah. So we might say something like, "Don't worry, I'll play with you. Let's go bake cupcakes together." Now, what's really fascinating is when we talk about this meta view, the ability to rise above your emotions, to experience them, but also rise above them. What we know is that this capability starts to develop in childhood. And the only way that children will recognize this is what sadness feels like, this is what anger feels like, is if they're allowed to feel it.
And to name it.
And to name it. Mm-hmm. And the only way they'll recognize that anger passes and sadness passes, when you're depressed, that sadness doesn't feel like it's ever passing. It's really important that we recognize that our emotions contain value, but they're also transient. And so when you allow a child to experience an emotion, to label it, and as young as 2 and 3 years old, if you say to a child, "Are you sad or are you mad or are you feeling a mix of emotions?" At 2 and 3, children are able to start developing the skill. So we want to try to really show up to our children's emotions and to help them to feel that the emotion isn't bigger than them. As soon as you're starting to try to fix an emotion, effectively what we're sending the message to the child is that the emotion is to be feared rather than enabling them to develop competence around it. So yeah, absolutely, this whole idea of, and I describe this in very, very practical ways in the book, but it's a critical skill set. And then lastly, and I know we're running out of time, is helping children to also develop their own strategies. So this idea of, instead of it being, "Well, why don't you go and speak to the teacher?" Or "Why don't you, have a discussion with someone?" Really saying to children, let's brainstorm, what are 2 or 3 things that we could do? What feels better? And then helping them to chunk that up. And again, even at the age of 2 or 3, if you say to a child, "Do you need some time to yourself? Or do you want to go for a walk with mommy? Or do you want to read a book?" Children are able to start developing that sense of things that they do can impact on their emotional experience. Critical skill set.
Great. Can you leave us with some practical, those are great practical tips for kids. Can you leave us with a couple practical takeaways for developing emotional agility in ourselves?
Yeah, so absolutely. So just, you know, from the different areas that I speak to, so just, you know, some of them that I speak about in more detail in the book, but one is we need to be able to recognize that our thoughts and emotions are thoughts and emotions. Who's in charge here, the thinker or the thought? So say you, for example, this is just highly practical. Say you're sitting in a meeting or you're about to have an argument with someone or you're about to leave the room because they're raising that topic again that you just don't want to discuss. So simply naming the thought or emotion for what it is. So instead of, I am stressed, I am angry, I am being undermined, I am going to leave, instead, I'm noticing that I'm having the thought that I'm being undermined. I'm noticing that I'm feeling stressed. I'm noticing that I've got the urge to get up and leave the room. I'm noticing the urge to shut down. All you're doing here, it's a very, very powerful linguistic hack, if you like. But what you're doing is you're starting to create space between you, the thinker, and the thought. I also speak a lot about how to develop these really important changes to habits that are fundamentally based on, you know, what it is that we value. So the idea of piggybacking, this whole thing of piggybacking is a very, very practical strategy. And another thing which is a little bit more time-consuming but is so powerful is work showing the power of putting things into language. When people are going through a job loss, for example, or a very difficult transition, there's this wonderful body of research showing that literally 20 minutes a day, 3 days of writing, if you look at people who engage in these writing exercises versus not, 6 months later, the people who have put in into language their experience do better. And it doesn't need to be just about a traumatic experience. It can be about what kind of leader you want to be or what kind of parent you want to be. This kind of putting into language, again, quite literally alters the physics of our motivation and it impacts on what is called the readiness potential. So as people get ready to act, there are areas of their brain that start to get activated. And these are more likely to be activated when we are clear about what it is we want to do and we've put stuff into language and its values aligned. So in the book, I talk about some very, very practical, you know, practical strategies around habit change, values, intentionality, labeling, emotions, thoughts, you know, this whole critical skill set. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In my line of work, we do a lot of leadership development, and that's the same concept. It's reflection, journaling, processing, articulating that helps you grow as a leader.
Yeah, that's
great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. So that is the last question that we have. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
So I hope you've enjoyed tonight's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Dr. Susan David, author of Emotional Agility, Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. Thank you to our audience here in Palo Alto and everyone who's joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.